If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at TNTradio.live. Critically analyzing national affairs. This is State of the Nation with Dan Mitchell, Brian McLean, and Lynn Shaw on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to State of the Nation. We're live from Central Texas, Virginia, I think, and New York City with Lynn Shaw, Daniel Mitchell, and myself. They call me Hesher sometimes, but I'm Brian McLean. Thank you for joining us for this live broadcast via TNT Radio. Today's News Talk, TNTRadio.live, on your interweb device. Feel free to call in today if you'd like to. The lines are open and the number is up there on the website. I'm going to launch right in because I got a couple. I'm going to try to cram three things in here. And I think Dan is going to have some great commentary, and I'm sure Lynn will too. But with regards to banking, First Republic Bank credit rating downgraded to junk is causing a stock to plunge. The FRB, First Republic Bank's credit rating, was downgraded to junk by two ratings agencies, causing its stock to dive. Fitch Ratings and S&P Global Ratings announced their concerns on March 15 that there was a risk that depositors could pull their funds from the California-based bank despite promised federal intervention. And then on top of that, we've got First Republic execs reportedly dumped $12 million in stock before bank chaos ensued there. On top of that, we've got a billionaire investor, one Bill Ackman, saying that he's extremely concerned by the federal government-backed infusion of $30 billion into First Republic Bank by 11 of the top banks, saying the plan will create a false sense of confidence and risks the spread of contagion. And just yesterday afternoon, 11 banks, including JP Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Citibank, and Bank of America, the big apex ones, said they would provide $30 billion to First Republic after the California-based regional bank saw its stock plummet amid fears customers would withdraw their deposits from the institution. Dan, welcome to State of the Nation. What do you think about all this?
Well, first, I'm in Northwood, Michigan at Northwood University near Midland, Michigan today. I just spoke at a conference, but fortunately, there seems to be good internet here at my hotel room. So I'm glad to be back here on the program. In terms of the banking sector, someone, and I forget who, had a very accurate statement. When the Fed slams on the brakes, somebody always goes through the windshield. And I think just like with Silicon Valley Bank, we're dealing with the consequences of the Fed's irresponsible easy money policies in 2020 and 2021, which set the stage for inflation in 2022, and now they're having to slam on the brakes in 2023. And if banks did not properly hedge, if they assumed that artificially low interest rates would stay low forever, they made mistakes and they should go out of business. And the question is, how can we limit the collateral damage to the overall economy? And that's sometimes that can be a thorny issue.
Yeah, I imagine it is. Lynn, welcome to the show. What do you think about this? We got another bank here downgraded to junk.
Thank you, Brian. Hi, Dan. Good to see you. Well, I have a very simple question. Who monitors Moody's and Fitch's, and how accurate are they? Who rates the raters? That's what I want to know.
Well, I can actually comment on that because I'm not a big fan of the rating agencies. They tend to, they drive by looking in the rearview mirror. I mean, if they were giving us warnings 6 months in the past about, oh, we might have some hiccups in 2023, I would have a lot of respect and admiration for their economic analysis and their ability to look into the future. But instead, they're sort of the people who yell, the barn door is open after the barn door is open. Now, it's not like they're deliberately trying to do anything bad. It's just that economists are lousy at forecasting the economy, and they're no different than the rest of and by the way, I'm an economist, so I'm criticizing my own profession. But we're just, if we actually knew how to predict the economy, we'd all be billionaires.
Interesting. Isn't there some sort of trend analysis that should be employed?
Right.
I mean, I see that in a lot of other realms. I mean, why? I understand you're saying it's an incompetence issue, but is there something else at play perhaps here? It kind of seems like this stuff should be easy for some of these people to see coming.
Well, here's the problem. People like me especially the ones who focus more on monetary policy, since I'm more of a public finance fiscal economist. But a lot of free market economists have been warning for like 15 years, ever since the 2008 crisis. We've been warning the Fed's been too easy. The Fed's been too easy. Now, it took what? You know, we were saying that in 2011. We were saying that in 2013 and 2017. Well, it's finally happened. And so the question is, if we're not great at predicting when bad things will happen, the fact that, you know, that they eventually happen doesn't exactly leave people with a lot of confidence, even in the economist that I like. Now, I think the difference now compared to, say, last decade is that in 2020 and 2021, the Fed, panicking because of the pandemic, added $4 trillion of new money into the system. And that was such a giant change that it couldn't be covered up. It couldn't be offset by competition from overseas. There was no way to dump that much new money into the system without causing an outbreak of inflation. And what was it? Warren Buffett, who said, when the tide goes out, you see who's swimming naked. Well, when the Fed slams on the brakes, you see what financial institutions made a bet that interest rates would stay low forever.
Well, there you go, Lynn. It seems still like the people at these banks, they should be listening to people like Dan and not, you know, behaving.
That's what I was going to say. You're stealing my words there. I was going to say, Dan, obviously none of this is working. So why do we continue on this path? I mean, why isn't it just blown up? We have some sort of new system, new rating, something. I mean, I'm a novice at all of this, but it obviously doesn't work. Why aren't they listening to people like you?
Because people like me were saying there was a problem 8 years ago, and obviously the problem never showed up. Now, people like me could rationalize, well, we were having easy money policies back then, but a lot of it was just flowing into financial markets, not into higher consumer prices. But that doesn't really matter. You know, no one's going to have faith in an economist's ability to forecast. And politicians of both parties, frankly, they can't resist the temptation when they're in power to press and pressure the Fed to have easy money. Because when the Fed's inflating, it feels good. When you're blowing up the bubble, hey, my house price is going up. My stock market portfolio is going up. There's lots of money to borrow. It seems fun when you're at the upswing, when inflation is first entering the system. Where we are right now, unfortunately, and where we were last year with higher consumer prices, we're now dealing with the consequences. But because it's been so difficult to predict when the bubble would burst, when the higher prices would show up, that's why there's not a lot of faith. I mean, I'd like to think that my advice is better than maybe some left-wing economist, but none of us do a good job with the forecasting. And so I think that's one of the reasons why politicians get away with, let's just say, some sloppy decision-making.
Okay. Well, that makes a little more sense to me, you guys. I mean, I suppose if bankers had listened to you 8 years ago, they would have missed out on 8 years of big loans and just stuff that they would not be able to resist, as you said. So,
that's a great point, because I remember asking a friend of mine who's one of these hedge fund guys on Wall Street, very successful, and I said, "Well, aren't you worried about it?" And he said, "Yes, it's probably not going to end well, but I'm not going to miss out on all the money I can make between now and whenever the bubble bursts." And so I think you hit the nail on the head. Everyone wants to benefit when the bubble is blowing up. And then the question is, who is really smart and can try to, you know, when someone yells fire in a crowded theater, you want to be the first one at the exit. And the really smart people on Wall Street, maybe some of the people with inside information on what's happening in Washington, they get out quickly. And it's normally the retail investor who's left holding their bag. Their 401k account goes down. Their businesses wind up suddenly starved of credit. And that's why the other day I was saying, the big lesson of this is not that the Fed shouldn't be tightening. They should, because they have to deal with inflation. The big lesson is they shouldn't have stepped on the gas in the first place. That's where they put our economy at risk. And by the way, the European Central Bank did that in Europe. The British Central Bank, the Bank of England, they did that in the United Kingdom. When central banks inflate, sooner or later, and again, it's difficult to predict, but sooner or later, bad things happen.
Okay, there you go. Slamming on the brakes and making sure they got seatbelts on while other people don't. For all the latest community events, rallies, marches, festivals, and fundraisers happening near you, then please visit the What's On Events calendar on the TNT Radio website at tntradio.live and stay in touch on TNT Radio.
Going beyond the headlines.
They break down the big story.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
After the loss of an unmanned aircraft earlier this week following a fateful encounter with a pair of Russian interceptors, the U.S. is reportedly weighing the benefits and risks of drone flights over the Black Sea. Here with the story, joining us now is TNT Radio News producer Adam Clark. So, Ruckus, we're having to rethink our drone operations over the Black Sea in the wake of this, huh?
I guess so, according supposedly to CNN, citing our infamous sources. They say the Pentagon wants to avoid escalation with Russia, but has not stopped flying over the Black Sea. So, on Tuesday, of course, Washington claimed that two Russian Su-27 fighters dumped fuel on an MQ-9 Reaper drone conducting a reconnaissance flight in the area, with one jet later colliding with the U.S. aircraft, If I'm not mistaken, this has since been basically kind of confirmed with video that we've seen. I don't know if you all saw that. It's pretty interesting. Moscow's Ministry of Defense, however, dismissed the accusation, insisting that its interceptors had neither come into contact with the Reaper nor fired a weapon, saying that the drone crashed due to, quote unquote, sharp maneuvers. Okay. Several officials have told CNN that the U.S. is now, quote, weighing the costs and benefits, end quote, of further drone operations. At the same time, Washington has not entirely halted flights while the review is underway, the report says. And another Reaper was sent to monitor Russian forces searching for the debris. Pentagon officials say they are, quote unquote, taking a close look at U.S. drone routes and at ways to reduce the risk of clashing with Moscow's military in the area. They are also said to be analyzing the potential intelligence benefits of such missions compared with the danger of escalation. One senior official told CNN the U.S. was concerned that curbing drone activities could adversely affect intelligence gathering related to the Ukraine conflict. However, the U.S. could still rely on other assets, such as satellites, the report states. I'll note here, they didn't say anything about the use of balloons. Despite the ongoing review, Washington is considering flying another drone over the Black Sea in the near future, officials said, without providing further detail. The U.S. has significantly ramped up intelligence operations close to Russian borders, seeking to provide Ukraine with valuable data. Moscow has repeatedly insisted that such activities make the U.S. a direct party to the conflict. On Friday, former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev, who now serves as deputy chairman of the Security Council, blasted the U.S. for sending its drone into the restricted flight area that Moscow has imposed due to the conflict in Ukraine, saying, quote, "To put it simply, the Americans went way out of line and there is no need to stand on ceremony with them," end quote. There you have it.
Well, yikes. Interesting. Wow. I saw some of the reports saying that they're suspecting that these jets dumped some kind of liquid on the drone in midair, like a fuel accelerant or something. That seems really unlikely to me. Maybe that is a combat operation. Obviously I'm not an expert. They don't have, I don't know. That just made no sense to me. And, the whole story actually doesn't make full sense to me when it comes to the UAV and the encounter with the SU-27s. It's coming out of the Pentagon, so I don't believe it. I guess that's all I can say. What about you, Lynn?
Are we claiming that this was negligence, a collision, an attack? Because I'm still a bit confused. Do we actually know? No, I don't think we do. Does it?
Yeah, right? That's my take.
Well, Lynn, so
we don't know. We don't really know what we saw. It. Yeah, we saw the video. We know this happened, but has anybody said exactly what this whole thing? No, nobody has said anything. That's my question. What is it?
Yeah. What do you think, Dan?
And I think the public wants to know. What do you think, Dan? Right.
Well, certainly the implication from what we're being told is that the Russians caused the drone to go down. Do I think that's true? Probably. But do I think that that there's a self-serving spin anytime our government tells us things? Yes. But is there probably a self-serving spin when Russian spokesmen say things? That's definitely true as well. But this underscores the fact that we live in a time of risk, because if a few things just happen to escalate and the U.S. does get directly involved, I mean, there's no question we are far more militarily powerful than Russia. But on the other hand, there will be a lot of collateral damage if the U.S. and Russia wound up with overt hostility. So let's hope that that doesn't happen, just like we should hope that when the U.S. sends warships through the South China Sea, because China claims this vast area of open ocean, let's hope that doesn't escalate to something. We live in a world with some governments that behave irresponsibly.
Yeah, true that. We're going to be joined by Martin Seif shortly here, and I'm sure he'll have something to say about this. Maybe we'll pick this up with him. Anything else on the Russia versus U.S. UAV incident here, Ruckus, before we let you go?
I was just going to say that, yes, there's video that's been released, and if you watch it, technically, it basically it goes against what either side is saying. So it implies that both sides are lying about the whole thing. So there you go, Lynn.
That would make sense. Both sides are lying. That would make sense.
Definitely.
Exactly.
To Dan's point as well. Yeah. Do we believe anything coming out of military industrial complexes from any country? That's probably the big question here. So much propaganda swirling around. It's difficult. But we keep an eye on it over here. Thanks, Ruckus, for helping us do that. You're listening to State of the Nation on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Trevoy Morich on TNT Radio.
Speaking of Mexico, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene has come out today and said, "I'm proud to co-sponsor Dan Crenshaw's legislation to declare war on the Mexican cartels. We must authorize the use of military force to eliminate the thugs who are smuggling drugs and illegal aliens across our southern border, leading to crime and murder of Americans, while cartel members wait for their fate to be sealed by our great military. We will put a hit on their bank accounts by sanctioning any government that supports or allows cartels to operate. Yada, yada, there's war going on that affects every single American, but it's not in Ukraine or the Middle East. It's on our southern border. And what concerns me is when she says, while cartel members wait for their fate to be sealed by our great military." Yeah, that's frightening, because this is like uncharted territory where we're headed. U.S. Special Forces heading into Mexico. I mean, Peter Zeihan said this is going to become Afghanistan. So, wow. Yeah. I suppose we were here, you know, like a century ago. So we just keep revisiting history on all fronts.
Trevoy Morich on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Let's take advantage of the freedoms that we have while we have them to advance the kingdom's objective, to be salt and light.
Freedom is hard. Election security involves you, involves the voters.
This election for people of faith is vital that we see a change, because the war against Christians is at an all-time high.
Transparency is the key not only to having honest elections, but to maintaining public trust in those elections.
Our ability to vote is not being withheld from us. No one's trying to stop you from voting.
The one place the American people can have a say is at the ballot box. That's why the Democrats and the far left are working so hard to get rid of all election integrity.
We cannot let our elections be anything but transparent. It is at the very heart of freedom in a free society.
And if we lose America, I mean, it's all over, because the world has looked to America for hope.
Free and fair at salemnow.com.
Our lines are now open. Call Brian, Lynn, and Dan now from the U.S. and Canada. Call 1-888-201-6425. From the U.K., call 033-0024-1026. And from Australia and New Zealand, call 1-800-670-310. Free speech is alive and well on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Our guest is a regular here at State of the Nation. He's a historian and a journalist, and his name is Martin Seif. Martin, welcome back to State of the Nation. How are you today?
I'm fine so far, and a very happy St. Patrick's Day to you too, Brian.
Oh, yes. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Look at Lynn, too. She is.
I'm glad somebody
today.
Brought that up. Thank you, Martin, because I am in the middle of New York City, and we have the largest St. Patrick's Day parade in the world. We have about 2 million people that flood our city. We have 150,000 people that march in the parade. So I'm so happy you brought that up. So I want to say happy St. Patrick's Day back to you and to all of our listeners as well.
And I see you're wearing the green as well, Lynn. That's really cool.
I am wearing my boa. I am ready. This is what we do in New York City. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yes. And Martin, let me introduce you to Mr. Dan Mitchell here as well. He is he's new here on State of the Nation, as are Lynn, my two new co-hosts here. We're having a great time, and I'm excited to introduce you to both of them today.
Happy to do so. Dan, a pleasure. And of course, you too, Lynn.
Thank you.
And I'm going to make my claim about St. Patrick's Day, because according to Ancestry.com, I'm at least 35% Irish. So I get special benefits today, I hope.
Well, no, because you're not wearing any green. So we're taking your benefits away.
Well, not only am I from Ireland, born and raised there, but my dad was an officer in the Free State Army during World War II, which only, of course, in Ireland was not known as World War II, but as the emergency.
All right. Amazing.
Always, as you know, we always have our own way of looking at things.
Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, let's play off of that today, Martin. Can we talk a little bit maybe about this China and Russia meetup? We're interested in this Russian energy firm. There's a headline that says Russian energy firm helping China's nuclear weapon program is a direct threat to the U.S. So the GOP House of Republicans are calling on Biden administration's national security officials to utilize the full application of sanctions, export controls, and diplomacy to block a Russian state-owned energy company from helping China to expand its nuclear weapons program, and warn that this relationship is a threat to our national security. What's your take on this?
The answer is yes and no. In the narrow sense, of course it's a threat, and of course they are absolutely right. What, of course, they don't say is our own insanely stupid, suicidal, aggressive policies threatening both China and Russia have driven them into each other's arms, and our own policymakers and the idiots in Congress in both parties have created this nightmare and are bringing us towards catastrophe, because we cannot fight Russia and China simultaneously, and we are in a collision course towards nuclear war, God help us, with Russia. And personally, I think all this talk about China invading Taiwan is an enormous red herring, not created by them, but created by our own idiots who are deluding themselves, because they want to think of themselves as the arbiters of the world. But the Chinese are not fools, to put it mildly. They don't have to take any risks. They only have to wait a handful of years, not even till 2030, to watch us wreck ourselves. And then Taiwan will fall into their laps and be forced to come to terms with Beijing and come under their total control without them risking a war. Without them risking a war. And this is the Chinese way. Americans play chess. They don't even play poker anymore. Poker is a much better game to conquer the world with. That was the national game of the American leadership for well over 100 years, from the Civil War through the 1960s and 70s. Nixon was our last president, I think, who was really good at poker. And it showed. But no, today they're all chess players. But the Chinese have a game of their own, guys. It's called Go, G-O. And the aim of Go is to win a war before a shot is fired, because you isolate and weaken your opponent and you surround them and you create a stellar constellation. So even if you have to fight a war, your victory in the war is automatically assured before you fire the first shot. And we haven't woken up to this.
Interesting. Yeah, it really does seem like we are in a vulnerable position with regards to that. The Go game versus chess. Some might even say checkers, depending on
situation. I mean, checkers puts it beyond them. They don't have the brains for checkers, but you're absolutely right. They think that the book of I heard a very interesting point just listening in before we started about this deployment towards Mexico. Think about it. We've sent scores of billions of dollars of arms we do not even have for ourselves to Ukraine for them to lose against overwhelming odds because they are not configured to fight a war against a thermonuclear superpower. And they're paying in blood for hanging on day by day. The Ukrainian people are paying in blood in a war they cannot win. And we are pushing them into it. God help us and God help them. And yet at the same time, we're taking on China and lecturing China. And we think we can sanction China when China has a bigger and better economy than we do. And now we're invading Mexico as well. Where does it stop? The book of Proverbs defines these people. It says they're fools. The mark of a fool in the book of Proverbs is someone who picks a fight with everyone or starts fires in every direction and says, look, I'm only joking. I don't mean it seriously. This is the definition of a fool in the book of Proverbs. And this is Victoria Nuland and Secretary of State Anthony Nuland and the President of the United States and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. They are fools by definition of the Bible.
Okay, well, that's a great setup for the discussion here, Martin. Please hold the line while we take a quick headline with today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Hey, we're getting back to the news. Back to
the news. TNT Radio News.
What the f***?
This is James O'Neill with a check of today's headlines. Germany's Minister of Health, Karl Lauterbach, who once claimed the COVID-19 vaccination is free of side effects, admitted last week that he was wrong. After 2 years of deliberations, the Surface Transportation Board this week approved the acquisition of Kansas City Southern Railway Company by Canadian Pacific Railway Limited. The combination will be known as Canadian Pacific Kansas City and will link the United States, Canada, and Mexico.
Globalist agendas, democratic rights at risk, corruption, propaganda. It never stops. For the news and views silenced by the mainstream media, by government and corporations, vote one. TNT Radio. Free speech always has a home here. Stay up to date with the latest live news and current affairs delivered by our lineup of expert commentators and hosts. Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's News Talk. This is TNT Radio.
We're with historian and journalist Martin Seif here, and we're discussing this concept of the tripolar superpowers here, United States, Russia, and China, in the wake of a Russian energy firm signing up to help China's nuclear weapon program. So I think that Dan or Lynn probably might have a follow-up question for you here, Martin. Do either of you have anything you want to ask at this point?
Well, I have a couple of things I want to say. I want to just break it down. I always break everything down, Martin, to the American public, what people can understand, what the listeners can understand. And my question is, why are they doing this? Because they can? Is that the answer? Why would anybody do all this destruction? And the other thing, and I digress a little bit with this one, but China also wages tremendous psychological damage. And I work with children and digital safety and tech companies. And the company TikTok alone, what is being done here in the United States, nobody is monitoring this. I don't care. There's all this in the news. We're going to get out of the government devices. We're going to stop at this and that. We have the studies, we have the stats that it is destroying people, young people in particular, the children. Yet our government allows that kind of thing with our kids. And they're waging all this other nonsense, as you called them, fools. I just don't understand what our government is doing.
Actually, I'll try to answer as best I can, because you're right, Lynn. There is no rational answer to this. There are irrational answers. But you've nailed it. You said, are they doing it because they can? And in fact, that's a very profound insight. Because you asked the right question, but the answer is an unexpected one. They're not doing it because they can. They're doing it because they can't. They're delusional. They think they can do it and they can't. Look, Bill Clinton allowed China into the World Trade Organization in 2000. For the last 20 years, primarily under two presidents, the two worst presidents in our history, both Republican and Democrat, George W. Bush, extraordinarily stupid president, and Barack Obama, who actually meant well but inherited and was locked into, really, I don't think had the brains to realize what was going on around him. But he didn't cause this chaos, but he did nothing to roll it back either. He simply followed the path he'd been locked into by George W. Bush and by Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton and George W. Bush were catastrophes, and President Donald Trump tried to roll it back, and our own deep state fought him bitterly and undermined him and sabotaged him every step of the way, every step of the way. Now, even Joe Biden does, at some level, realize you have to roll it back, but he doesn't have a clue how, and in a way, it's too late. It can be changed, but they don't know how to change it. Because money answereth all things, and because we let China into the WTO, we allowed China to basically hollow out all our industrial base that happened already gone to Japan and South Korea and other gallant allies in East Asia. And I don't blame them for it. If our leadership are so self-destructive and greedy and treasonous and stupid, why shouldn't other countries take advantage of them and of us in our own national interest? And none of our people woke up and until Donald Trump came along, tried to change the policies and tried to change the leaders. But you got to do that. But what does that leave us with? It means China can buy everything. And they can get away with everything because, again, as the good book says, money answereth all things. This is how America rose. It's how the British rose before us. When you have the best industrial and wealthiest industrial base in the world, you can buy anyone and anything. And the British did that when they built the British Empire. And we did that for 100 years while we were building the American Empire. Before, over the past half century, a succession of idiots, but most of all Clinton and Bush Jr., threw it all away. They threw it all away. So what are we left with now? As you say, Lynn, these policies are insane. And the interesting thing is, they're not doing it because they can. The policies are doomed to fail. You cannot sanction an economy of 1.3 billion people that has a vastly larger industrial base than you do. It's the height of stupidity. We can't even bring Iran to heel, which is tiny compared with China, with our big, brave, wonderful sanctions. We put sanctions on Russia. Remember, we were always told Russia was falling apart in 2014. The British Daily Mail newspaper, I'll finish on this point with this, last week ran some very interesting photographs. They ran photographs of British supermarket shelves all over Britain, nation of 70 million people, almost loyal ally, and they were empty. Britain's economy is collapsing because they were so stupid as to leave the European Union. Lots of things wrong with the European Union, but Boris Johnson didn't have a clue what to do with it, apart from, you know, come up with some cheap slogans that he and his people were able to con the British people. But they didn't have a clue how to handle it. They're drunken apes. They're children. They're children. I mean, they need your help, Lynn.
I don't mean to laugh, Martin, but, drunken apes, I laughed. I mean, that's a very descriptive way to describe these people. Yes.
I'm a reporter. I'm not sophisticated. I'm taught to describe things as they are. At least
and that's what
the way
we like.
It's the New York way, I know, and it's the old Irish way, too. Well, of course,
yes,
the two are the
like
same.
Yes, I like it.
Yeah. And Martin, can I jump in and push back on you a little bit on Brexit? I was a big fan of Brexit for two reasons. Number one, in the long run, the European welfare state is going to collapse and the European Union is going to turn into a massive transfer union, taking money from Northern Europe and giving it to Southern Europe to prop it up before the whole thing implodes. That was the first reason. It's a sinking ship and best to get off the ship before it starts to sink. But the second reason is that, well, if they got out of the European Union and didn't have to have harmonized taxes and harmonized regulations, they could have followed the so-called Singapore on Thames model. The problem is, and this is where I partially agree with you, is that Boris Johnson wound up raising taxes, raising spending. He was following the Brussels on Thames model instead of the Singapore on Thames model. So Brexit gave the UK the sovereignty to make its own decisions, but then they foolishly made the wrong decisions.
No, I don't agree with that. I agree with the first half of your story completely. You're absolutely right, of course, about the nature of the EU down. But you made the good point. It's going down in the long run. And the famous British economist, he's very unfashionable now, but he had a lot of wise and shrewd street smart things to say. And he did a lot of good for his country and our country in fighting the Great Depression and financing the victory in World War II. And that was the late John Maynard Keynes of Cambridge University. Look, I'm an Oxford man. I'm saying a nice thing about a Cambridge guy. But Keynes pointed out when somebody said they should do policies which would ruin the country in the short term because they would be great in the long term. What was Keynes' answer? In the long term, we are all dead. Is the EU sinking, as you say? Yes, of course, I agree with you. Of course it is, for exactly the reasons you so clearly point out. But look, they built the Titanic in Belfast. Maybe not a tactful thing to say on St. Patrick's Day, but there you are. Who survived the Titanic? The people in the lifeboats. What would happen if you were on the deck of the Titanic right after it hit the iceberg and you jumped into the Atlantic Ocean? You would die immediately. There was only one survivor, and he actually survived for a very Irish reason. He got himself drunk in a limitless quantity of whiskey before jumping overboard, and that kept him alive for an hour and a half. And then he was finally picked up by one of the lifeboats. But this is Britain. The European Union is a trading bloc, biggest in the world, almost 500 million people. The British cut themselves off from that, and for all their talk about being fast and agile, they don't know what fast and agile is, and they cannot be Singapore because they're too big to be Singapore. The Singapore model doesn't even work in Israel, which has a population of 10 million. We see the uneducated reactionary side of Israel right now taking over the government and rising up and crushing the entrepreneurial high-tech side of Israel that all Americans love. The past is rising up against the future in Israel, that because a high-tech model, like you said, can work in the south of Ireland, where there's only 3 million people. And you're right, of course it works in Singapore. It cannot work in a nation of 70 million people in Britain, which is why Scotland, which has its own oil, which has its own high-tech, which has a manageable population and a flourishing agriculture of 16 million, is breaking away from England, and why the United Kingdom is going to die. The United Kingdom is going to die, and they will not be able to afford to bring in the food they need. They grow enough food for 15 million people, but there are 54 million people, 55 million people in England and Wales once Scotland is gone. Where will the money to pay the surplus for the food for the extra 40 million people coming from? You can cut all the taxes in the world. It isn't enough. You got to have decent policies. And I know these people personally. I've covered them for 30 years. You would not trust them to lick a latrine in a 7-Eleven with their tongues. They are not remotely. You see, you are a smart guy, Daniel. You are a successful man in what at least up to now has been the most successful society, thank God, on earth. But we see, alas, the way it's going now. But you therefore assume that because these people mouth what sound to be admirable philosophies, they can put on their underpants the right way in the morning. No, they cannot. They need Lynn's help for a lifetime.
That's right, Martin.
Absolutely.
Wait, is she going to help putting on the underwear or cleaning the latrine? I'm not sure she wants either.
Dan, role. This is a family show. This is a family show.
Exactly. The point is, your Irish soul comes out, bless you, Dan. Exactly. The thing is, you would have to start with the basics. One and one equals two, two and two equals four. That is beyond these people. Since they're geniuses, they don't have to know that. They don't have to balance the books. Gosh.
Well, there is a big difference between common sense and book knowledge, that's for sure.
Yes. There's Absolutely. A line I love from Isaac Asimov. Such folly smacks of genius, a lesser mind would be incapable of it.
There you go. All right, Martin. We got to let you go, but we will be in touch and we'll do this again really soon. Always appreciate your input, sir.
Always a pleasure, Brian. Dan, Lynn, a joy. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Martin. Right.
Thanks, Martin. Okay, there he goes, everybody. Martin Seif, once again, you're listening to State of the Nation on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
I want you to listen to the police chief of Charlotte, Mecklenburg, North Carolina, Johnny Jennings, just for a second.
37 minutes. 37 minutes. I want you to think about how short of a time period 37 minutes is. You're probably going to be in this media room longer than 37 minutes. Your lunch break was probably longer than 37 minutes.
37 minutes, that's how long it took for an EMT who was accused of a sexual assault by a patient inside an ambulance to be released back onto the street. 31-year-old Akin Baiwaju Joseph Opadel was in jail for 37 minutes before he was given a $15,000 unsecured bond and was released.
We have to stop sometimes and ask ourselves, you know, what kind of message are we sending to our victims, our most vulnerable people within our society?
Bigger question, what message are we sending to the criminals who know that they can grab a quick nap in the clink and be released to find yet another victim? Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Governments around the world are wasting billions of dollars in carbon capture and storage. Such programs oppose the benefit of enhanced photosynthesis for a greener world and improved crop yields. Much of the funding goes to geosequestration, which requires vast amounts of energy to pump carbon dioxide deep underground into geological formations. It would be better described as oxygen burial, given oxygen makes up 73% of the mass of carbon dioxide. For most of the last 600 million years of life on Earth, atmospheric carbon dioxide concentration exceeded 1,000 parts per million. And for much of that time, including when the dinosaurs roamed it, it was over 2,000 parts per million. Today, it is only about 415 parts per million. Burning fossil fuels liberates carbon back into the atmosphere from which it came.
You're with Brian McLean, Dan Mitchell, and Lynn Shaw and State of the Nation on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Okay, our guest is National Right to Work Committee Vice President. He has worked for the National Right to Work Committee for more than 21 years and currently serves as its VP for legislation. He's responsible for directing the committee's efforts to advance the cause of employee freedom in Congress and in the 50 states. His name is Greg Morad. Greg, did I pronounce your last name right? And it's a pleasure to meet you. Thanks for joining us today.
You did, Brian. Thanks. It's great to be with you.
Okay, excellent. And I'm here with Lynn Shaw and Daniel Mitchell. And we are curious to get your take on what has gone on in Michigan. Now, just for the listeners out there who may not know, Michigan state Democrats have voted to repeal the decade-old right-to-work law. So hundreds of union supporters filled the halls of the Michigan Capitol on Tuesday this week as Senate Democrats voted along party lines to support the repealing of the right-to-work law in a state long considered a pillar of organized labor. Can you talk to us a little bit about this and tell us what this means for right-to-work?
Sure. It's a real tragedy, of course. The Democrats, when they took power in November, weren't talking about repealing the state right to work law because they know it's incredibly popular. They issue polls over 80% when you ask workers if workers should be forced to pay union dues. But of course, as soon as they took power with the help of a whole lot of money from those union bosses, first thing on their agenda was repealing the state right to work law to help those union bosses resume collecting money from workers who don't think the union is serving their interest. And so it's a tragedy for those workers in Michigan. Right to work has been an economic boom for a state that had really experienced a forgotten decade before right to work was passed. Jobs were leaving, people were leaving. and the right to work law really started turning things around. And we're all very concerned that Michigan is going to see a return to the days of companies not wanting to be there and jobs leaving and people having to leave to chase those jobs. It's really very sad.
Yeah, that is sad. You know, Michigan is one of our automotive centers in the country. What do you think about that, Dan? I mean, we've seen what happens when things go bad in that industry before, especially in that state. I've got a friend of mine whose mom worked at GM for years and years and years, and you know, I heard how her career ended, and it was not good.
Well, what's a coincidence is that I'm in Midland, Michigan, at Northwood University, and one of the major programs they have at this school is automotive training for people who want to either work in car dealerships or people who want to work in management in the auto industry. And actually, when I go to the dinner for the conference this evening, I need to ask about that, because you would think that Michigan should have been very sensitive to the fact that this is a competitive 50-state internal market, and companies have a choice where to build factories, where to expand production, and by having a right to by repealing right to work, they are sending a signal to the business community that this is going to be a more expensive place to do business. They're sending a signal to workers that if you are employed here as opposed to employed at a auto company in Tennessee or some other state, that you're going to have some of your paycheck diverted to the unions, who, of course, then will recycle it into the politicians as they try to prop up their special privileges. So it obviously cannot be very good news for the competitiveness of Michigan, but it's a raw exercise of political power.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is, Daniel. You're exactly right. We call it the forced dues vicious cycle. The union bosses take money from every worker's paycheck. They spend it electing politicians that will then do their bidding. Those politicians vote to funnel tax dollars back at the union and increase their coercive power, and then take that money, and the unions take that money and put it back into the campaigns of those politicians. And it's a down spiral for the state.
Yeah, it's sort of the version of recycling that you find with government.
that was going to be my question. I was going to say to please give us some examples of, you know, the biggest abuses that you've seen. You've kind of laid it out, but what, just for the listener to understand, what I mean, you pretty much just laid it out. What are some of the biggest abuses you've seen?
Well, one recent case that resulted in a victory for us, for example, a woman named Charlene Carter was a Southwest flight attendant for 20 years. And the union had been taking a part of every paycheck for 20 years and spending it on politics that deeply and personally offended her. And when she had the temerity to post her political views on her own personal Facebook page, the union bosses mocked her for it. And when she sent a private message to the head of the union, Audrey Stone, saying she intended to support Stone's recall as the union president, Stone then colluded with Southwest officials to have Charlene fired. And one of our attorneys took that all the way to a jury trial. Jury found both the union and the airline guilty. They ordered them to give her job back and awarded her $5.1 million in damages. So it's a great story in that it highlights the abuses of forced unionism and the great work being done by our lawyers. But at the same time, it also highlights the continuing problem and how much work there is to do. She's got her job back now. She was back in the air again with Southwest just this week. And already she has to start surrendering part of every paycheck again to the same union bosses that had her fired.
Well, let me ask a follow-up on that, because wasn't there, I'm an economist, not a lawyer, but wasn't there like a Janus decision that said that you no longer had to pay union dues for the portion that just went into the political activism as opposed to worker representation?
Well, that was the Beck decision a long, long time ago that said you can't be forced to pay for union politics. Okay. Unfortunately, it's almost impossible to enforce, because it depends on getting an honest accounting from the union as to how much they're spending on politics, and you can't get it. You have to sue them union by union to get it, and even then, they are not often giving you real numbers. And so we have employees try to exercise their Beck rights. They get told, oh, well, we only spend 1% on politics, which is just truly absurd. The Janus decision you referenced, was just a few years ago. That one said that no government employee can be forced to pay anything to any union at all. The idea there is that a union of government employees everything it does is by nature political. Even the contract bargaining is bargaining over spending the public purse. It's a political act. And if it's politics, you can't force people to pay for it. And that is still in force, even in Michigan. When they repealed the state right to work law, they did it in two pieces. And the public sector piece of it basically said that as soon as that Supreme Court Janus precedent is overturned, we'll start taking dues away from public employees in Michigan again.
Okay, thanks for clearing that up for me. I knew Janus had something to do with the unions, but got confused with the Beck decision.
Yep.
And Greg, is there any research that you could share with everybody about what percentage of union dues actually do go to politics? And if so, which side of the politics might they be leaning?
Well, it's pretty clearly documented, at least in terms of their PAC contributions, that 95-98% of it goes to Democrats because those are the folks who then turn around and increase their coercive power and funnel more money back into the unions. In terms of what percentage they spend on politics, that is really hard to quantify, but we do know and can document they spent $12 billion in the last two-year election cycle. That dwarfs all of the big money players you hear about, the George Soroses of the world and the Koch brothers of the world, and all of those people utterly dwarfed by the amount of money big labor spends on politics. It really, forced unionism is the engine that drives the entire big government left-wing machine.
$12 billion, that seems excessive, doesn't it, Dan?
Well, I've been in Washington working in the think tank world for decades, and I can assure you that a lot of people on the center-right are very aware of the problem, but what can you do about it when you have states like Michigan passing laws like this? I mean, the left, give them credit for one thing, they know power and they know how to try to achieve the money to make their power have more muscle to it.
They do have that, and they do know that, and they've been all about the power game for a long time. Now, I am confident we're going to get Michigan's right to work law back. There is going to be a backlash against those politicians that voted to wipe out right to work in Michigan, and it might take an election cycle or two, but we're going to get it back again. Ultimately,
is there
of course,
a
go ahead.
Is there a referendum process, or do you have to wait for a change of control in the legislature and governor's mansion?
Well, there is a referendum process in Michigan, but the Democrats in the legislature pulled a little stunt. Measures with an appropriation attached are not subject to the referendum. And so even though there's no need for the government to spend any money to repeal a right to work law, they attached a small appropriation measure anyway so as to make it no longer subject to the referendum. Governor Whitmer several years ago pledged that she would never sign any piece of legislation that pulled that stunt. Guess what? That pledge went out the window when it came to repealing right to work and paying back the union bosses that put her in office.
Well, I'm just thinking about that poor teacher who may go to her or his job and they don't agree with the politics. And then what happens to them? That's where
my
mind goes.
They either knuckle under and continue paying, or they...
Which is what has happened.
Now, again, in the Janus world, that's no longer the case. Theoretically, under Janus, you can say, you know what? This union isn't serving my interest. I'm a public employee, and I can't be forced to pay, and I don't want to pay. We all know, of course, big labor still has a number of illegal coercive tools that they use to get public employees to knuckle under and pay anyway.
Do you have any data on how many employees have exercised their Janus rights?
That's hard to come by, and it varies quite a bit by state, but anywhere from highs of 70-80% down to lows in the teens, depending on the state and the strength of the union culture and the union intimidation.
All right, well, that's progress.
Yeah.
Well, I also brought up the teachers because I'm familiar with like the teachers union and a lot of teachers that talk to me, and they simply say to me, we can't fight it. We can't put up with it. So we just go along with it, which is so sad. That is what they report to me.
And there is a lot of that going on. You buck the union and there are consequences on the job. You get shunned by the union teachers and the ones that have been brainwashed by the union. You can be given worse assignments because the school board and often the administrations of the schools are in bed with the union. And so you can be given assignments that aren't what you're trained for. You know, you might be a specialist in teaching high school math and you get sent to teach kindergartners instead. That sort of thing happens as well as a way of punishing teachers that oppose the union agenda.
Yeah, that's not good. No one likes to hear that. We know how hard those people work and how unfairly they're paid and how much difficult their job is getting by the day here. Okay, I hear the music here, Greg. That means we're going to have to let you go soon. But I noticed that Michigan, in their right to work law after it was enacted in 2012, they had been steadily declining. The union had an all-time low last year of only 10%. Real quickly, do you think that 10% number is what pushed this? They said, oh, this is untenable.
That's certainly part of it, but it's not just that. It's that they really, really, really like collecting dues from people that might not want to pay it. Money is pretty darn addictive, especially when it's funding your political agenda.
Absolutely. Okay, well, National Right to Work Committee, definitely check them out. Okay, you can learn a lot up there, and we'll be in touch, Greg. Thanks for stopping by today at State of the Nation. We'll talk to you real soon.
Thank you, Brian.
All right, there he goes, everybody. You're listening to State of the Nation on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.